back to The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
9:55, look who's in the big chair now, Leslie Roberts. Ty, just a little undone in the way that only an anchorman can still make it look professional.
Better roll up my sleeves if you're talking
that way. You normally have them rolled up by now, but...
Well, look, I got a new shirt, and they did the little bit of, you know, where they put that monogram on there, so I'm just showing it off. New shirt, new monogram.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. I'm such an anchorman.
You are.
In all the worst ways. Except for today, we had some good news in the middle of the morning, of course, that Pfizer says early data suggests their COVID-19 vaccine is effective. Now, everybody's sort of saying, what does that mean? How soon do we get it? Well, we're hearing some of the small print. It has to be stored, for example, at minus 80.
And that's a problem.
Unless you're in Siberia, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's gonna be a very tough one to distribute. Very tough. That's not the best choice out there. Of all the vaccines we've already pre-ordered, that one is not the best. Maybe it'll be the first, but I kind of see that going to healthcare professionals and others. I don't see that being a general vaccine. I kind of feel like we'll have to have another one come through and be successful in phase 3 trials aside from that one. Plus, it's only a handful of people so far that have been either vaccinated or had the placebo and also got the disease. They're saying it's 90% effective. I know a lot of people are already raining on that parade. I would say, look, if it had been the other way around and it was only 10% effective, that would be very bad news. So this has to be good news. They need twice as many people to be infected before they really are at the end of their trials. But it's a good interim. In fact, the standard is only 50% effective rate before they could be approved.
Seriously.
Now, they also have to be safe. But 90 would be pretty awesome.
It would be. They're now filing for an emergency use application with U.S. regulators, which means that they can move to the next level. This is in the race to the finish. They're now closest, right, with this?
Yeah, that would put it by the end of the month, probably, that they would apply for an emergency use. That doesn't mean they'll get it right away.
Yeah.
And again, that would be a limited number of people that would get it. I don't think they should go wide at that, because if something goes wrong, all vaccine credibility is going to be damaged. We got to be really careful.
I read a stat out of Japan. I interviewed a doctor who runs a supercomputer, which was basically credited with keeping a lot of the numbers low in Japan. I interviewed him this morning on CTV Morning Live, and he was saying that the risk to the Japanese population, and I assume it's true everywhere, to the seniors in particular, is dozens of times higher to get COVID than a normal, healthy adult. Dozens of times. That's pretty shocking. I've never heard it put quite like that. So don't we think we should
get higher to get it,
yeah,
or to get really sick with it?
Probably get sick with it, because we are all the same, but to get it and then deal with it, I think.
So he's not talking about survival rate, he's just contraction rate.
Correct. No, the opposite. Not survival, in terms of how it affects you. And I guess survival rate would go in there too. I that's a good question. I didn't clarify. But the takeaway for me was that was the first time this kind of put everything into perspective in terms of the risk.
Yeah, if you're going to get sick and you're older, it's much higher.
Right. Dozens of times, according to this guy. And now, shouldn't they get it first? Shouldn't seniors get it? And is this one of the places where you're going to get your senior discount? And, you know, hey, give it to me first, you know, if you're 50.
Well, I think seniors should be among the first. But, you know, first the people doing the vaccinating should get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to be
exposed, potentially.
Exposed. They have to get up close to vaccinate people.
Frontline
people
workers.
Treating COVID patients should get it. Then I would say the most vulnerable seniors, and those are the ones who are in long-term care facilities.
Okay.
And then seniors beyond that. And then after that, younger adults who may have diabetes or asthma or some of the other conditions.
What age do we qualify a senior to get a vaccine when they roll this out? 65?
How old are we?
That's not old enough.
I think probably 65 is the standard we use for everything else. So,
well, I don't know.
It might be 60 with COVID, though, because then 60 shows wherever the you start to become the most vulnerable.
True. I guess that's what you use, the stat there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the seniors discount you can get on Points Day at Shoppers.
Yeah, it's not Shoppers Drug Mart on a Tuesday where if you're 55, they insult you.
I refuse to take those credits. You know
I'm
that.
Way too cheap to say no.
Maybe I'm the dumb one here. Hey, our friends just, you know, in Eastern Ontario, just outside of Ottawa, they moved to the yellow zone today. We're still in orange after the change on Saturday, but they're moving on up to the east side of Ontario.
I didn't know. Were they in orange or they just...
Yeah, they were. They never went into the same as we did. They never went as deep as we did into red. A couple times, Dr. Paul nearly pulled the trigger, but he said they were able to maintain it. They had isolated some of the clusters. The rural versus, you know, where we are more dense here also made it easier for him not to make the call or make the call not to. And ultimately, he said today, and he's going to join us in a couple of minutes, they're moving into yellow, which is one away from green, Bill. That's pretty cool. On a day, or actually a day after, we set records across the province of Ontario and many provinces right across the
country. Sure, but the whole point of this new system is that we can be more local, that you shouldn't be punished living in, I don't know, Carleton Place just because numbers are high in Toronto. Look at Peel's numbers. That's the one we should really be concerned about. And it's not even Peel. It's mostly just Brampton. Peel has a population of 1.3 million.
Okay. Bigger than us.
So Brampton is, what, 400,000 maybe? And most of the cases are there. And they're almost as high as Toronto now.
They canceled banquets and weddings now, so they closed the banquet halls until January because they see that as a source that sort of led to those.
Yeah, numbers. Religious gatherings and stuff, yeah. Too. They'll just end up being in people's homes.
That's a concern, right? Because you're
well.
Got
listen, you
plans,
know, I really noticed this weekend that so many of the people I know are now going to dinner parties. It's become common. Dinner parties are back on, and it is not a good idea. It is not a good idea. You live alone. So Dr. Verich has always said, if you want to adopt another family, you can do that. But even you should be careful. You shouldn't be having dinner with more than just us, Leslie. We're not being possessive and jealous. No, there's too much of that going on. I got invited to three different indoor events in people's homes just this weekend.
Wow.
And I was talking to someone at an outdoor event in our backyard, still socially distanced outdoors.
Yes.
And they didn't even touch. They brought their own stuff to drink and water bottles and stuff. We spent an hour out in the backyard. But one of them had just visited on business Victoria, BC. You know what he said?
Mm.
People were laughing at him there for wearing a mask. Take it off.
Really?
In meetings, in closed-in rooms. People out west right now, because they never really had the first wave, they do not believe there's a problem at all. They've become very American. They are looking down at people who are going to meetings wearing masks. They're throwing parties. They're having a good time. And they're starting to pay for it. Those numbers are going up. And here's the problem. When we party at home, they close the economy. That's what happens.
Yeah.
Because they have no other way to control it. So they take away things that may not even be as dangerous because it's not like they can come to your house and check. So if we want the economy to remain open, if we want to move to the next level, we got to behave better away from restaurants and banquet halls. And right, we got to behave better. My kid had a hockey practice this weekend.
And?
So I feel very safe there. Don't carpool your kids to it.
That was the issue.
Don't go together to restaurants afterwards.
Don't hang
That's
out after.
The real problem now.
Yeah. No, it's true. I'm just seeing that Christine Elliott, the health minister, is saying that already reacting to the vaccine, says that Ontario's vaccine strategy is a work in progress. They're coming up with a plan to make it fair and equitable for everyone, whatever that means. So we won't know yet because she gave an early press conference because of what's happening in Peel region, new measures that are going for specifically that region, and she was asked about the developments on the Pfizer end. So more to come on that, and exactly to know. And we should know in advance, right, before who gets it first and come up with the
plan. Well, I think the sooner we know, the more smoothly it'll go.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. What if you feel you're in that group? If you're isolated and you're healthy, do you get it based on that? Or does it come down to your age and your health?
I think if you're in one of those groups and you're isolated, we still should vaccinate you because we've all been isolated too long.
Yeah.
And that's why people are breaking the rules at home.
Well, and it takes
a toll. We just emotionally have had enough.
It takes a toll on you when you don't have. I mean, I know as much as it is, we were kind of joking off the air that, you don't have time alone at your own house because you got the kids, you got Sylvie, you got your mom-in-law, and it's a situation where, hey, sometimes being alone is a great thing until you're alone all the time.
Right. I mean, but it's both things are a problem in their own way.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Right?
They call it cabin fever. It has a name for a reason.
Yeah.
And people in this country, when we were pioneers and we were literally locked in all winter, you know, store enough food to get you through the winter and hope spring comes early. People have lost their minds. People went, you know, into the deep end because we're not built to stay, even with a small group of people, exclusively for that long. Mm. Not everybody's happy in some cabin in the woods. And even those guys tend to send out letters. So dangerous ones. It's not a good way for most of us to live.
Dating during the pandemic has also been a challenge. Imagine you're a single young guy, single young woman, and you know you're used to meeting somewhere. And you know, I've heard on the weekend, friend of a friend, not me, friend of a friend.
Sure, of course.
I swear, went out at a date. It was a coffee date, walking, and they were wearing masks until they sat down, and then that's when they actually had the big reveal. You know, they took the mask off, so you know that's what your face looks like in person versus the selfies on Instagram type thing.
Wow, that could go badly.
It could, right? Exactly.
Sometimes teeth make the man or woman.
Said the Scotsman.
Yeah, I still have a full set. My age for a Scotsman, that's a pretty big accomplishment.
Absolutely. Hey, before
some people look better with the mask on.
Yeah.
Because it focuses on their eyes, might be their best feature. Sylvie told me this morning that eyebrows are the new lipstick for women.
Okay.
She always believed you can go outside without makeup, but you got to have lipstick.
Lipstick, yeah. My grandma now used to do that.
You can go outside without lipstick, but you got to have the eyebrows well manicured.
And you're talking about masks and how they sometimes affect the way you look. Some people look better with them. It's like a beard. Don't you find some men look better with a beard?
For sure.
They're so popular, right? But beards right now. And then somebody shaves them off. It's like, who the heck are you? And what the hell happened to your looks?
Yeah.
You know? It's kind of crazy.
I've found it doesn't work either way with me.
Hey, can I ask you quickly about how the teaching's going with your kids, both in high school? Because educators, your favorite group, they're worried that the COVID era is harming students and their future irreparably.
Well, we talk about it and we worry about it. Things are sure better this fall than they were in the spring when they weren't in school at all. I still worry, though, that my kids are in high school, that the supervised off days never did come to fruition. Didn't happen. I asked people to send me an email this morning if their kids are doing it. I didn't get any. Okay. I got some from people whose kids are like mine. Basically, they get a homework assignment. You can't expect their teachers to do it because they got another class to teach the day your kids are at home. I don't know what happened with that. Like to ask the education minister because he swore it was happening.
Yeah, he did.
And we got an argument about it. It's not happening. It wasn't happening then. It's still not happening now. I don't expect it's going to happen this year. And so even with homework, I just don't think they're getting as complete an education as they did. Teachers are working hard. They're doing a great job. I can't speak for every teacher, but the four teachers our kids have this quadmester have all been excellent. They're making the most of it. They're worried about their own health and safety as well, but they're doing a great job. We could not be more happy unless they actually had 5 days a week of school.
Can I tell the quick story about Magali and her 97% where she got an email from her teacher? I'm going to tell it anyway. Got an email from her teacher said, I couldn't wait to give you the results. You need to know this now. I mean, good on her knowing that in a pandemic, this is the kind of good news. These are the nuggets that make or break a kid.
Yeah, the kids weren't going to get their test results back for 2 days, but she was struggling initially, and she has a tutor, and she's working really hard. And suddenly, she went from not passing to these honor roll marks.
It's crazy.
And the teacher said, I couldn't wait the 2 days to tell you. I just wanted to say how proud I am of you. And there are a lot of great teachers out there, and I've never doubted that. I don't like the way the unions represent them a lot of the times, but there are so many good teachers. We have four of the really great ones right now.
And you got lucky, right? In a pandemic, you want four great ones. Are your kids required to put the cameras on during class? Because some are not required when they're on the Zoom.
What class?
The Zoom.
There is no Zoom. This
they're
is
doing
my
no
point.
Zoom. Okay.
That is not happening. Maybe for kids who are home full-time it's happening.
Yeah.
It is not happening. On the days they're supposed to be supervised and learning online at home, they're doing homework assignments from the day before, period. There's not been one Zoom call to our kids this school year. Zero.
Specifically, something to celebrate for our friends just next door in Eastern Ontario. The region, of course, I just mentioned earlier, moved to the second lowest level in the province's framework of COVID-19 scale. It's now yellow. So what does it mean? More importantly, how far are they from green and how do we get there too? Dr. Paul Remiliotis, Medical Officer of Health in Eastern Ontario Health Unit CEO. Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Good morning, Leslie.
I guess you had a good night's sleep last night.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it's nice to have some good news to celebrate.
Yeah, it really is. You know, although, like I said, I've told our partners in, you know, in municipalities and so on that, you know, it's a good news story at this point, but let's continue to make it a good news, because it can turn sour pretty quickly with this virus. So let's not let our guard down. But in general, it is good news. You know, we had a lot of people, especially businesses and municipal authorities, very worried that we would sort of go the other way and perhaps, you know, elicit closures and those type of things, which we've avoided. But again, we're keeping a very close eye on things.
We got into orange, which you were until now. You're yellow. What's the difference?
The difference really is the rate, in terms of the definition, it's the rate of cases you get per 7 days, the positivity rate, level of community transmission, hospitalization rates, and those type of things, and sources of the infections. Those are the differences. So as you go to the right of the scale, which is go to the more restrictive, you see higher rates of positivity. And so those are the differences in terms of the definitions moving from one zone to another. And then within those, you have different measures for different types of what we call site-specific measures. So, for example, restaurants. When you're in Protect, there really is no limit to the numbers of people in the restaurant. Mm. Of course, based on 2 meter, you know, 2 meter distancing.
Right.
Whereas in the orange, 50, it's a maximum of 50. In yellow, the restaurant's going to open till midnight. In orange, the restaurants close at 10.
Right. It's big for them.
Yeah, it is big for them.
Yeah.
I know. So it's more limitations, although they're not closed. And then the other big difference is that in yellow, there's a limit six per table, whereas in restrict, it is four per table.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's all these little differences, and it has to do more with the number of people at the same time, crowding, and those type of things.
And you were able to do this, even though it comes down to, I'll put this all into context, the numbers may not have necessarily changed, but you're able to control them because of you knowing where the clusters are.
Exactly. And that means that we're containing it. We know, for example, we had a family where one person got it, and then everybody was on isolation, and then the whole family was positive. So that's it's not a surprise.
Yep.
And however, the good news is that because one person had it, we isolated the whole family to begin with.
And you controlled it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So those numbers, it's more than just the count. It's also how they broke out.
Exactly.
And when you find one source responsible for a dozen, potentially, that is like almost one big case.
Exactly.
And when you're taking into consideration where to move.
That's exactly right. So it's not just the actual numbers, the numerical, the quantitative. It's also a qualitative. And then what we're doing as well, Leslie, is that in addition to reporting these daily to the government and looking at all these measures and indicators, I also, and along as with the other health units, the health units that were in orange and now are in yellow, or, you know, in those areas there outside of green, I actually have to send a daily qualitative report to the ministry saying, okay, yeah, today we had 10 cases, but you know what? There were seven were from the same family.
Boom.
You know, that type of thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have to have that qualitative sort of on-the-ground feel and indication of where we are. So we have to take the whole thing into context.
You've talked about the importance of the difference plays when it comes to rural versus urban, Ottawa versus your region. That being said, do you think we can go into yellow or be able to do some of the benefits for restaurants soon here?
I think if you look at the rates, you look at the numbers, you look at the positivity, I think they're going in that direction. Don't forget, it's almost now the 4 weeks since the initial, you know, modified stage two. So I'm encouraged by these numbers. I think that Ottawa, unlike GTA, did very well. You can see the numbers. You know, the numbers are predominantly in the GTA area.
They just came in now. I'll just read them.
Yeah, I didn't see them yet.
Christine Elliott just tweeted them out. So we have 1,242 across the province. Not good. We have 483 new cases in Toronto. Not good.
No.
279 in Peel. Not good. 107 in York Region. Is that bad? Anything over 100?
Not bad. They're up there as well.
Okay, for Ottawa, another day in the 70s, Dr. Paul, 74.
Well, there you go. So you know what the thing is? It's the amount per 100,000 per 7-day increase. That's what we're looking at. So to me, that seems to be stable. With Ottawa, I haven't seen their positivity rates. I know that the hospital admissions, were higher a couple of weeks ago, but I think they're stabilizing at this point. So those are all good news. So you can see that again.
Yeah.
The trends are that although the numbers are driven by the GTA area, the numbers in our area, including Ottawa and Eastern Ontario, my region, are stabilizing.
Doesn't mean we can have dinner parties, folks. And the reason
no.
I say that, because before you came on, Bill was talking about the fact that he got a couple of invites. I got a couple of invites, even if it's a crowd of four or five.
We still, you know what? We're Tell still me. Saying stay home,
yeah.
stay safe. Don't. And the other thing, too, is we're trying to sort of discourage people from moving from one region to another at this point. The more we stay home, the more we adhere to just sticking with our household, our household being our bubble. I think the better the chances are that, for example, we'll stay in yellow and perhaps go to green, and Ottawa would, progress into the yellow zone.
It's things aren't great in Gatineau right now. I don't have the number, but apparently they're on the rise there. Shouldn't we consider it one region since we go back and forth so
Well,
much?
Yeah, thing is, that's true because I've got the same on the Hawkesbury
yeah.
side. I've got the same in that side as well. It should be looked at. You need to see what's going around you as well. So then there again, you see, when you're looking at the numbers, let's say now we have, X number in my area, but all of a sudden I see a surge right across the bridge.
Yeah.
That will be another thing that we need to take into consideration.
Absolutely.
It's not written in that framework.
Yeah, we say 74 or whatever it is today, but if you have to count Gatineau to actually reflect the community at large.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it goes back and forth. Yeah.
It does. And it's a provincial jurisdiction thing, but at the same time, regionally,
yeah.
because of the way we operate as a city,
yeah.
There is actual spillover.
There is spillover, yes.
Yeah. Dr. Paul, it's always good to get your take. Thank you, sir.
No problem, Leslie.
Until sure. next time. Dr. Paul Romeliotis, Medical Officer of Health, CEO, Eastern Ontario Health Unit. 10:18, we'll take a quick break. You're listening to News Talk 580 CFR.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
The debate has been around for months. Are kids getting the education they need here in the province of Ontario? Now we're hearing from the teachers' union, maybe setting them up for major problems down the line. We're at the end of the first quadmester. If that's how your kids are doing, how are they doing? Have they fixed those issues that they had early on? Because it's kind of gone away from the headlines. But if you ask any family, they'll tell you it's not perfect. Not that it's ever going to be perfect. So what is the state right now? What still needs to be done? And what about the future? Do we really have to worry beyond just this year that it may come back to bite us somehow for the kids? Jason Bradshaw is back. He's a science educator and secondary school teacher with the Peel District School Board. Jason, thanks for your time.
Hi, good morning.
So we got the educators, or in particular, we've got the union sort of waving the flag here and say, guys, this is great, except that kids are losing motivation, engagement with school, and it's irreparably harming their futures. Do you agree?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily harming kids' futures. I think that we're very hung up on whether or not kids are falling behind, but we have to ask ourselves, falling behind who and falling behind in what way? Because we're all in this together right now, and all kids, not only just in Ontario, but all throughout Canada, all throughout other countries, we're all facing this new style of learning. So I think we have to take a step back and understand that maybe we shouldn't be comparing kids to where they would have been had this not happened.
Because, as you said, everyone's affected by it. That being said, does this mean we have to slow down the education going forward until we catch up? Is it a long-term thing? Or is there a point where we can just say, okay, guys, we're going to, once things get back to normal, fast-track you here and, do 6 months in four for the next four semesters or whatever?
Well, again, I think it's this mentality of wanting to stay up to pace where we would have been if this hadn't happened.
And we can't do that?
It's almost kind of a denial of the situation, right? I think what we need to do is focus on what's best for kids right now. And then when this is all over, we can decide how we can move forward from there.
Okay. What are you doing these days teaching?
So I'm fully online right now. So as you said, I'm in the Peel District School Board,
yeah.
and my board assigned me to online for this quadmester, but that may change in the second quadmester.
How is the first quadmester going for you? Are the kids watching?
Well, I would say that it's actually improved a lot from how it began. And there were definitely a lot of roadblocks to begin with. There were a lot of things that we needed to figure out. But I think it comes with a shift in the mentality and the expectations. And it doesn't mean that we're lowering our expectations, but it's understanding that we have to put the needs of the kids first. And that goes beyond worrying about things like their marks or their or like if they're handing in assignments on time all the time. There's so many different factors, and I think we have to be conscious of doing what's best for the kids, even if it's not what's best for their report card grade.
Sounds to me like we got to resign ourselves to reality check.
That is one way of putting it. And I don't want anyone to think that in any way educators are giving up or that we're lowering our expectations. But there's certainly a different mindset that I think needs to be taken. Like, I know that when this quadmaster began, and myself and a number of my colleagues who are teaching online, we were really concerned about how we could cover our whole curriculum, especially because the online classes began late in PO. So we were definitely very concerned about how can I fill this whole, complete this whole course in this limited amount of time. But I realize now that the shift has to be in what can I do to support my students and not necessarily how much curriculum can I cram into them.
Got it. We know there's no exams at the final exams, yeah, which helps. So you tailor make everything based on where your specific class is to determine how the kid's doing.
Yeah, I think that's actually the best approach. And,
yeah,
and there's no one correct way to do this. I think as educators, one thing that we're very good at is being responsive to the needs of our students. And I think that's a lot of the time the problem that happens with the public and with the government telling us what to do and shifting the plan like halfway through the game. And every day it seems almost like we're being asked to do something new. But at the same time, we're the ones who are dealing with these kids and we're engaging with them and we're trying to respond to their needs and at the same time meet whatever the government or the ministry is telling us to do at a given moment.
How much longer are you working this year versus last year?
Oh, I would say that I'm putting in a lot of extra time, and it's difficult to even put a number on it because for myself, working online and I'm able to do so from home, it really blurs the line between home time and school time. So it almost feels like it never really ends on some days.
There's an option I understand where you may, in your next quadmaster, do at home and in class at the same time. So what, you're going to be in the classroom with one cohort and the other half will be watching online?
Yes. So that's what's known as the hybrid model. And
okay,
a number of districts are moving to that, including Peel for our secondary schools. And essentially it is just as you describe it. It would be me back in the classroom teaching students in person, and the online students, instead of having a dedicated online teacher, would basically be watching a live stream of my class.
How do you feel about that? I don't see a downfall or downside.
I would say it's very limiting. And
okay,
well, compared to what we do now. So right now I'm teaching fully online and I'm able to, again, respond to the needs of my students. I'm able to give them my full attention.
Yeah.
But imagine a situation whereby I have to be responding to the needs of the students in front of me. Meanwhile, the students at home are simply watching through a screen. I can't really be engaging with two groups of students at the same time. It's a convenience factor in terms of logistics and money, but I don't think anyone believes it's the best way to teach.
Well, and we've already determined best is not going to happen this time around. You made that clear. That being said, Jason, I mean, so you're basically getting your class into two cohorts, which used to be every second day, some online, some not. Now we're going to basically have half of them in the class, the other half at home. If it's the same number, let's put a number, a round number of 30 there, as opposed to two classes of 15, can't you do that? Because you did it before.
Well, that's not entirely what it's going to be, actually.
Oh.
In fact, it will be three cohorts. So we're actually still going to have two cohorts that are going to be juggling between coming in every other day. And at the same time, there will be a third cohort who's always watching online.
So we're going to have fewer teachers?
I think the idea behind this is that, yes, it can be done with fewer teachers, because I think the motivation to shifting to this was, of course, so many
shortage.
More students were opting for online that there didn't seem to be enough
teachers
to fill
right.
that online demand.
Okay. But since you are the one who's setting us up for reality, and that is, look, it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be as good in the past. If this is solving a problem, which is a big one, a teacher shortage, shouldn't we at least give it a chance?
The thing is, I'm not sure that there is, in fact, a teacher shortage the way it's being portrayed by the ministry, because I personally know a lot of young, qualified educators who are still looking for full-time employment. So
really?
I don't understand how the ministry can be saying there's a shortage of teachers when I know teachers who are looking for work.
That makes no sense. We keep hearing they're asking retired teachers to sit or coming back.
I know, and I'm as confused by that as you are, and I think that's maybe one of the points that the union is trying to clarify.
And they're fast-tracking some of these kids in teachers' college, as they used to call it, so that they can come out and at least be unqualified, but at least in the right zone.
I feel like maybe it's a logistics problem, in that I feel there are the teachers out there, there are the qualified people, but maybe they're not in the right places, and if they need to make adjustments and move people around, I think it can be done, but I think they're just looking for more of a quick fix.
Here we are 6 months into it, and we haven't learned a lot of lessons, and other than the fact that it's not going to be the way it's supposed to be, we're going to do the best we can. In the meantime, the logistics, to your point, still have to be worked out. It's a work in progress. Can we agree on that, Jason?
Definitely. It definitely is. And I just wish that maybe more planning had happened during the summer.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's a bit late to look back on that now. But
yeah, learning on the job, as they say. Hey, Jason, yep. I appreciate it. You always give us a great snapshot. Jason Bradshaw is a science educator, secondary school teacher with the Peel District School Board. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
10:32, let's break for news. News Talk 580, CFRA.
At Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580, CFRA.
Time for our roundtable, the news stories that have people talking this morning. As always, I'm joined by my colleagues from CTV News and CFRA News, Annette Gerner and Chris Holsky. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
All right, let's talk vaccine. You know, that's a huge headline grabber, but is it really as advertised, Chris?
Well, they're talking about a 90% success rate in the interim results of their phase 3 study. Definitely encouraging for sure, but that is all that it is. It's encouraging, but nothing definite at this point. They are looking at having some sort of emergency approval by the US FDA by the end of this month, possibly. Then Health Canada may not be that far behind them. However, it is the distribution from that point on. Don't start jumping up and down thinking that this is going to be in Canada by the end of the year or even at the start of next year. Because even if that is the case, we're not talking about an instant rollout to 20 million doses that the federal government has ordered here to all parts of the country. Even if there is some kind of release of this vaccine, chances are it's just going to be extremely limited to a very, very select portion of the country. And maybe something more widespread would start to come out maybe by the middle of next year. There's still so many maybes associated with this.
Is this where we run their music? Wah,
wah, wah. Yeah, right. Not quite as exciting as it sounds. They still have to test out how long it will last and then if it's effective in both seniors and young people. So they still have a lot of questions in the trial.
Though we can say we're getting closer and closer. Christine Elliott, our health minister, was out this morning already in front of the cameras talking about some measures in Peel where they have some problems, of course, going on with COVID. She was asked about this new vaccine news this morning, and she said, we don't have the rollout plan for Ontario when it comes to vaccine yet, but it will be fair and equitable. Here we are, as you know, as the former or the president, the outgoing president, says it's rounding the corner towards a vaccine, and technically we could say that by the new year, potentially here. Shouldn't we have it by now?
Honestly, I don't think they need to have one yet because we are still looking down a far way along the road. However, they need to take some lessons from some of the other instances that they've had in terms of the back-to-school plan and the amount of testing issues that we had when that was going on. Round two, during the second wave at certain long-term care homes. I think they need to start prepping for what their vaccine plan is earlier than whatever they think it is right now. But is that immediate? Is it the most important thing that they have to look at right now, today? I'm not so sure. I think there are more pressing matters in Ontario than trying to decide a full-scale vaccine rollout plan when I still think we're far away from anything like that happening.
I say they should be getting on it. I mean, not necessarily that it's the priority. I agree with you there. But look what happened with schools. It was like 2 weeks before school was starting, a week before school was starting, and everyone's going, come on, Premier, where's your answer?
Like, did we not learn that lesson?
Exactly. And that, I think was a good example as to how it was last minute. Now, given that the pandemic was very fluid, things were changing daily. So I understand why there is a need to make official whatever they decide kind of last minute. But I don't think that means they shouldn't be already having roundtables, sitting down with experts and starting those discussions as to, look, who are we going to do this for first? Who's the priority? How do we do this? Who hands them out? Pharmacies or doctor's office?
Yeah. It's a template.
And I mean, because let's face it, we're all going to be fighting to get that vaccine when it becomes available.
For mom.
If they do have a goal or should have a goal, then I would say that by the end of this month, they should make up their minds on if there is a limited supply. And I actually guarantee there will be a limited supply. Who gets it first?
Yeah.
I think they need to know that within a matter of weeks. But that's not the same as rolling out an entire vaccination program for the entire province. That is a decision that they can make quickly and they should make quickly.
Can we assume initially some people are going to be disappointed? Should we get that out there now and say, guys, not everyone can get it. Even if you're in one of the groups that checks the box, then maybe you're going to have to wait till round two.
So, well, here's the truth is that giving a vaccine to like a handful of people is not going to help the spread or prevent the spread of COVID-19 very much, because it's not just getting a few people vaccines. The real effectiveness comes from when you've got like a 90% prevention rate, as this so has, when as many people as possible actually go and get the shot.
It's preventing it from that one person getting sick, and potentially.
There's some real logistical questions about this as well, because it's not just one vaccine that they would need to get from this Pfizer shot. It would be two separated by 21 days. So you have that to worry about. The fact that these vaccines need to be stored at a temperature of minus 80 degrees. So you need the equipment that is going to store these vaccines properly. Is that you need to think of? And there are still questions about, once you get this shot, how long is it going to actually give you protection for? Is this going to be like a one and done, like say your measles? Well, actually not the measles vaccine, but there are vaccines that you only get once and then you're finished. Or is it going to be like the new flu shot, where you go in and you get your flu vaccine and you get your COVID-19 vaccine at the same time every year?
I've talked to people who don't want to get the vaccine, people who I thought weren't so-called anti-vaxxers. But when it comes to this one, they're not interested. Do we have to make this mandatory?
Is it because they're afraid that it will be rushed through, though, not necessarily meet all the standards for approval? I think that's where a lot of people have the fears, right? Because
I mean, think about
the rhetoric that's been coming out of the United States for the past several months. It's coming. It's around the corner. It's right. You know, I mean, that gets into our minds and makes us kind of fear a little bit that, well, are they going to roll this out before it's actually proven? And the answer is no, they're not going to go and do that. It will run the course of all these tests and have to be Health Canada approved. So I think once it does come out, it is going to take some time. Like Chris said, I think it's months still away before we see it. But then when it does come, I mean, personally, I will be going and getting it. I see no reason not to.
Yes, same.
What if there's a good percentage that won't? Then they have to look at it and say, look, we can't.
Well,
I don't think you
can make that mandatory.
You know?
And I don't think.
No.
I'd still like to think that given what we did to eradicate polio and the measles in this country, that I think people are going to come around and go get this shot.
Listen, the flu kills people, 3,000 Canadians every year, and it's not a mandatory immunization.
But
right?
a lot of people don't perceive the flu as dangerous. They never have.
Right.
And I think a lot more people are recognizing the danger that COVID-19 presents. Now, don't get me wrong, the flu itself does present a level of danger, but compared to the vaccines that most of us got as kids, as polio and measles, which were presented more that way.
There are a lot of parents right now who don't want to give any of those to their kids.
And it's not mandatory you do either.
No, but you know what? They're in the minority. We have seen those viruses pop up again because of that segment of parents.
Yes.
But at the same time, though, while you can't make it mandatory for everybody to go get a vaccine, you can say, okay, well, if you want your child to go to school,
they
have to be immunized.
Yeah.
And that is a big step. And I think it's one that I can see coming. Honestly.
Well, the campaigns will be coming, right? The same way they roll out campaigns every year for flu shots, we've seen them from public health agencies at all levels of government to go and get it. And that will come along with the vaccine.
I think really there will be a bigger feeling of security as this goes on, because we are talking about a process where Pfizer's going to get its levels of approval from different health bodies. But while they're at working, you got to think that Moderna is still doing their work and all the other. It's like we're going to end up, I think, with more encouraging results from more and more vaccines, as even the Pfizer, who they're the front runner right now, even as they get closer.
Yeah. Our friends next door in Eastern Ontario, just outside of Ottawa limits, into the yellow zone. We're still in orange, so they're going in the right direction. The next stop, green. Dr. Paul was on with us earlier. Look, he says there's a difference, rural and urban setting, meaning we're more dense situations here. That being said, their restaurants are allowed to open till midnight. But please, if you're in Ottawa, don't come and visit Eastern Ontario for dinner. I'm watching the numbers. You know, we had such a great week last week until the end of the week. We've now doubled into the 70s again, province-wide, 1,300, 1,242 today. Majority of them in the GTA, don't get me wrong, and that's why we've got the more you know, geographical zones as opposed to one province or one size fits all. Should we stay where we are, or are we ready to go into yellow?
I don't think we're ready to go into yellow yet.
Yeah.
I'm the same. But I mean, we could be a week away from it.
Listen, Dr. Sharkawi was saying we shouldn't even be where we are today. We should have stayed where we are. And we talked about that on this program not too long ago when we thought we were not going to be moving out of this. Was before we were considered the red zone. We were just calling ourselves scaled back, right? Like into phase two. We thought, oh, that 28 days is going to come and go and we're still going to be in it. What? I mean, I really didn't foresee that we would even have moved where we are right now. Obviously, there was enough pressure on the government given what we're experiencing in terms of mental health issues, in terms of businesses suffering. But I think there's a lot to what Dr. Sharkawi and some of the experts that he is saying he speaks to on a regular basis, that let's stay put for a little while. We don't need to rush this. We are back in business in terms of indoor dining, gyms, and all those things that we were fighting for in the last 28 days. I think it's time to stay put for a little bit. Let's play this out. Not to forget, Christmas is coming. Our mental health is going to depend on a lot as well on what we get to do at a time of year where it's all about family.
Yeah.
I know they have the stated guidelines in people's minds of how far we need to go to push back into red in Ottawa, but I've got to think, and I'm not going to say that she would disclose it, that Dr. Etches has some kind of number in mind when she's looking at daily cases of when she might lean in that direction. Ultimately, it is still going to be at her discretion. I mean, I know we have these set out guidelines, but I feel like just like horseshoes and hand grenades, that close is actually going to be good enough when it comes to making decisions here.
Educators, an article in the Globe today says, educators worry COVID era is irreparably harming students' future. I just talked to a high school teacher from the Peel region near Toronto. He said, look, there's no way we're getting the same quality of education. We have to accept that. And don't worry, at least the good news is your kids may be not where they're supposed to be in terms of in the curriculum and the grade they're in, but every kid's
they're
in the
all
same
in
situation.
It.
Yeah,
they're
we're
all
in it together. Yeah, I know.
I still don't take comfort in that. I know a lot of people say that to me as a parent, and I worry about my girls and that they're at the right place for where they should be in terms of their learning. But everyone says, well, they're all in. And I'm like, well, then they're all failing. I mean, I try not to be negative like that, but that is worrisome. You know, it is worrisome for their future. But what's the alternative, right? The alternative is not being in school, being hunkered down a little bit more, or not wearing masks and taking greater risks. I think, I mean, I'm no expert in health or governance or anything like that, but when I'm an expert in parenting, and when I look at it from a parent's perspective, I think we're doing the best we can.
But forever, this is what he's kind of saying. No, and that's when we go back to what is the normal or the old way we used to do it, do we just make them work harder that year? Catch up?
I think, you know, kids are pretty resilient. I think they're going to come around, and it may depend on the age of the child. It may depend on where they are at, right? Like, it's going to be far different for my littlest one who is in junior kindergarten compared to someone whose child may have been in their senior year of high school and getting ready to kind of, you know, launch the next stage of life. It's going to be very different depending on where your child's education, journey in education is, I think.
I really don't see anything in the way of them trying to, in theory, make up when they get back there, because that's not a very easy thing to do. Yeah. What I've looked at through this whole thing is that there are elements in terms of our education where there are world circumstances beyond our control. And I'm actually thankful to a degree that we've had a stable education system for as long as we did before this threw a bit of a fly in the ointment is how far it was going. So I don't know. I think it's important to note that right now it is a level playing field. And when it's over, I don't think you're going to see anything in terms of like a big stretch or big push.
And we don't know how long we're all going to be smarting when this is over, because let's face it, they're not going to switch on. Everything's going to go back to normal. We still have consequences, mental health or even physical health with the COVID-19, which had become the COVID-25 pounds. That being said, you know, this is the thing. Everyone needs to take that deep breath and sort of say, let's get through this and then figure it out. Hey, Chris Holsky and Ed Gerner, always great conversation. Thank you, folks. 10:49, we'll take a break. The very latest from Washington, News Talk 580, CFRA. When the bones are good, the rest don't matter. Yeah, the
pain could peel, the glass could shatter. Let it break. This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Let's get the latest from south of the border with the president-elect and the VP-elect, of course, ready to take office. In fact, some key decision-making happening today. But apparently some key people, especially in the Republican Party, starting at the top right now, aren't quite there, ready to accept it. National correspondent, NBC News Radio, Michael Bauer joining us. Good morning, sir.
And good morning to you. And Leslie, there are some Republicans that are saying, look, President Trump, if you don't have any evidence of any of these concerns over whether or not votes were valid, if you're not able to present anything, then it's time to move on. You should be ready to concede on some level. Even, in fact, not just aides or advisors indicating that, but you're seeing people like Chris Christie, a close friend of President Trump, somebody that ran against President Trump but also helped him through all of the debate processes, saying, if you don't have evidence, it's time to move on. So there's a lot of pressure, but you're also hearing from inside the White House right now that the atmosphere is toxic, that the atmosphere is manic. Two things that you think, oh, yeah, that kind of fits President Trump 100%, that he has been livid with his lawyers, according to what we're hearing, because he says that they are inadequately prepared for this election battleground, particularly as it is presented in Pennsylvania. The place that he just seemingly can't get out of his craw right now is the place that was the last one called for Joe Biden. Again, Joe Biden's home state, he was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania, but didn't stay there long. This is a situation where he won that state, apparently. That was the last one that pushed him over the edge to have him become the president-elect, and that is, in particular, not sitting well with President Trump. So he has made it very clear in statements to people inside the White House he would not be, at least at this point, attending any inauguration of Joe Biden, whom he referred to as the phony president, and that he is going to continue to protest being cheated in this fraudulent election, and that he is, at least we're expecting today, to see some lawsuits coming from President Trump's legal team in regards to that fraudulent election. So we don't know what it's going to be just yet. There have been reports over the weekend that made their way around social media indicating concerns over whether or not people who had died in this country were voting in this past week's election. There have been a number of states, including two of them that were focused in that particular story, Michigan and Pennsylvania, where you've had Pennsylvania attorney generals go, no, in fact, we've gone back and checked and we've had absolutely zero proof provided that any deceased person has voted in the 2020 election. These are things that happen with regularity in this country. It's the dumbest thing ever, Leslie, but there are people who go, oh, look at all these voter registries and all these people who had died, and yet they're still voting. That's why we send ballots out, and that's why when they find those votes, they discard those votes, and you're not allowed to make that happen. One case in Michigan that was a part of the story over the weekend was, oh, a 119-year-old woman voted. Well, not exactly. I mean, the same woman who's 74 years old, when she went and get herself an absentee ballot so she could vote and not have to go into a building where there was a fear of COVID, they messed up her birth date, and literally the computer labeled her birthday as 010101, as in January 1st, 1901. That would make her 119 years old. She's 74. You do not mess with a woman's age at all, period,
especially
ever.
In that direction.
No, and this is something that she was very angry about. She said, yeah. No, I voted. It was clearly a clerical error, and it's been fixed. So what's the problem? So if those are the types of stories that President Trump and his team are going to use as a legal concern here, I don't think they're going to go very far with this. And that's where I think this will be the first time, if we start to get any of these legal lawsuits coming out of here, that we'll have perhaps, and it's a big perhaps, some element of evidence and at least a direction of knowing which direction they're looking to go, with probably more legal briefs about to make their way out over the remainder of the week.
We're hearing from high-profile Republicans like Mitt Romney sending their congratulations. Yep. However, we haven't heard the likes of key Republicans like Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader.
Yeah, you're seeing, and some of that silence is deafening. Some of that is when you're hearing from, or what you're not hearing from, the Mitch McConnells, and you're hearing from Lindsey Graham. Like, Lindsey Graham is out and out saying, well, every vote should be counted, and if there are illegalities, those should be investigated. By not saying that kind of stuff, I think you're getting Mitch McConnell saying the same kind of thing. Like, well, yeah, then all of that should be investigated. So we're not really stepping out and saying much of anything else. And I think that is a very clear message that is being sent to President Trump, that he still has power over this Republican Party, even though technically he may be headed for a lame duck session over the next month and a half. And so they still want to get stuff done. They still want to feel some element of power over the next month and a half, and that's why they're sticking with. I think you're going to see that trail off. I think you're starting to see little by little, day by day, Republicans like Mitt Romney and others going, all right, this is how the process goes, and it's time to kind of step up, get your big boy pants on, and say, we didn't win this, and let's move forward from here.
President-elect, meantime, Mr. Biden, making some key decisions as he starts to assume the office slowly but surely.
Yeah, it's some exciting news. People are very thrilled to see the type of he's pulling together not just his progressive agenda that the far left element of the Democratic Party is interested in hearing more about, that he's going to say he's going to make good on an incredibly progressive agenda going forward. But you're seeing, and this is truly important right now with the massive numbers that we're seeing in this country of COVID, his COVID task force. I'm not even sure the president's White House task force led by Vice President Pence is still together. Like, they're a band that broke up in the 90s and nobody's even sure if any of them are talking to each other anymore. The Dr. Birx that you've seen out and about telling people to wear masks, Dr. Fauci you see every once in a while, the White House has been leaving him off of any kind of press tour. With the numbers that we've got, to see that Joe Biden's pulling a very well-educated team together, a team that will know how to kind of tackle this element, and then we're getting reports today that there may be some good news coming from Pfizer's vaccine.
Yeah.
That's all great news. It's the starting point. And again, the fact that you're beginning this process says that we imagine in the next, well, certainly by January 20th, that there will be a transition of power of some sort, no matter how much the president is kicking and screaming.
I want your feedback on an analysis I read over the weekend saying COVID is the issue that gave Biden the election, given the results so close. Without it, Trump could have been reelected.
That's possible. I honestly do think that COVID became the issue for President Trump. So anybody that was willing to recognize COVID and recognize that it was a fatal virus that needed to be dealt with, I think would have had a chance to win. It wasn't exclusive to Biden, but I think that was probably that was the number one thing on everybody's mind heading into this election, on Americans' mind. How are we going to control this? And what was going to happen coming up here in the fall and winter. So to have Joe Biden accept that, say that we would have scientists that would be looking into this and that he would put that team together to take it seriously when the president was going a 180 on that, saying, oh, no, it's already been completed. We've already done it. It's over. There's nothing left to this COVID, and we're tracking in 100,000 new cases a day. It's clearly a detachment from reality that was bound to show somebody had to do something and recognize this. It just happened to be Joe Biden, and I think that that's a good move going forward from here.
All right, national correspondent for NBC News Radio, Mr. Bauer. Michael Bauer, thank you, sir.
You got it. Stay safe.
You too. 11 o'clock, let's break for news. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Many times since Saturday when the election was called down south, I've heard a lot of people say, well, now the hard work begins for the president-elect. First on the agenda, what does the president-elect have to do to tackle the COVID-19 pandemic? We made mention, Michael Bauer did from NBC just before the news break there, about the record numbers, 131,420 COVID-19 cases on Saturday alone. They've reported over 100,000 infections four times in the past 7 days. So where do we begin? Let's get some insight. Dr. Maciek Boni is an associate professor of biology at Penn State University. Maciek, always good to talk to you. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on again, Leslie.
Hey, just tell me, what's the mood like where you are these days with the change in the election?
Well, the mood in my community is pretty good. I mean, everybody's happy to have a president-elect who's now going to listen to scientists. Of course, there's a lot of other important differences in this particular president. So in general, a very good mood.
And where does he start? If you were sitting on his task force like he's putting together today, what would you tell him?
Well, I mean, everything can start on January 20th when Joe Biden takes office. And there's two immediate areas that you have to move forward in. One is all the general types of distancing measures that we've already been practicing, improving those. And the second is vaccine distribution, as it's likely that at that point a vaccine will be ready or nearly ready for release. So those are the only two interventions we have available to us, and it's likely that in January case numbers will be high, so we'll have to move very quickly. On the distancing and general epidemic control side, the first thing we change is communication. We make sure to take that away from the politicians, put it back in the hands of scientists, and start telling people to reduce the sizes of their events, wear masks, put in some restrictions around large events, school reopenings, or whatever's necessary at that time.
I was going to say, it's interesting to hear you, because on our side of the border, there's one thing that's missing from your list that we have here. Lock down the economy when necessary.
Well, these measures that we're talking about, the masks, the small group gatherings, the extra hygiene, the six-foot distancing, those are the lockdown. And some people will choose to call it a lockdown. Some people will choose not to. But any combination of measures like this is a partial lockdown, a near-complete lockdown. And, of course, in the most extreme situations, it's going to be a complete lockdown.
Okay, give me, because that's our lockdown here. We just came out of a 28-day semi-lockdown where there were some restrictions were lifted. They reopened indoor dining and restaurants, which had been closed for 28 days. But only 50 people maximum in every restaurant and four per table. Gyms, they were closed. They're now reopened, but again, some pretty serious measures put in place to protect you from the spread in times when people are working out. The only thing that surprised some people is making the masks mandatory, even when you're on the treadmill. That being said, these things are not on your list yet.
Well, so limiting the size of gatherings, that's one of the key things to making sure that the virus does not transmit successfully.
Yeah.
So in some states right now, these gathering limits are at 10 or 15 people.
Okay.
And effectively, just between you and me, effectively that's a lockdown because you are closing lots of businesses,
yes,
like gyms where you'd have hundreds of people. I think it's good that the politicians have decided to not call it a lockdown and just to explain in simple language that, for example, gyms are closed but restaurants are partially closed. Just give the people the facts and don't get into the politics of whether it is or isn't a lockdown.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to the science here and your professional opinion. Would you, if necessary, close restaurants and gyms? Would that make a huge difference?
Gyms, I think so. And restaurants, in the highest phases of the epidemic, yes, definitely. And especially in winter because it's going to be indoor dining. So if you're in a risky period or a very risky period, a typical restaurant should only be at 25% capacity. And frankly, if you're willing to do that in the most risky periods, that should be 0% capacity.
You know, we had a serious problem with private gatherings. People who didn't go to restaurants, they would just get together. And that's where, in fact, when the numbers, the data came out, this might be of interest to you, just 5% of the transmission / outbreaks came from gyms, 2% from restaurants. The majority of them were schools and private gatherings. Now, the schools we managed, right, because we decided to make, we made that choice, and they're managing them. That being said, it's never going to go away. But the private gatherings became the real sore point.
Okay, so in the U.S., we're not able to get data at the level that you guys are. So we couldn't say right now whether it's 2% in gyms and 5% in restaurants. But we can say that there's cases and transmission both in schools and universities.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the challenge is we do have to accept that some types of things are more difficult to close than others. And I think it's acceptable for people to agree that the threshold for restaurants and gyms should be lower than schools, as, you know, schools perform a critical function for children and all,
yes,
of society and letting some people go to work. So, for example, in a school, it's a better strategy to put in very strict masking, distancing, lower density measures. But in a gym, when case levels are high, it is simpler to close the gym for a month and then find a way to compensate the business,
yeah,
when the gym's able to reopen.
That's what we're doing. That's what we're doing up here, but it's at a point now where it's not enough, they're saying. And a lot of gyms, unfortunately, with these numbers, are struggling to survive. But slowly but surely, they're reopening. For example, we had 74 cases in the city of Ottawa today, which would be a number that any major city of a million plus would love down there, I'm guessing.
Yes, 74.
Yeah. I know.
A city of a million in the U.S. would be a welcome news.
It would be. I wanted to ask you about the 70 million plus people who voted for Trump. Many of them are anti-maskers. They're maybe the hardest people to get on board here.
You know, winning this group over is going to be difficult, so I'm not a sociologist, but this is going to be our biggest challenge over the next decade. I don't think people expected Trump to expand his coalition. And the messaging does have to come back, and other Republicans have to get behind it, that A, the virus is serious, B, all these public health measures are important, masks, distancing, etc.
You know what they did here? They handed out fines to people who wouldn't do it. People who were having parties, $880, $10,000 for the person holding the party. Do you see your bylaw people in these cities writing tickets to people who aren't wearing masks when indoors, for example?
In some communities, that's possible. So in,
yeah,
my college town, because we have a fairly progressive and peaceful and non-divided community, we do have a fine for not wearing masks outdoors and indoors. But you're right. In some places in the United States, this type of fine will just not be possible.
It'll come down to the state, the governor, red versus blue, maybe? Is politics once again going to play a role in this?
It will, and ours are local. Ours, it's not even the governor, so it's our borough, which is just 50,000 people. Because we're a peaceful, non-divided, happy community, this fine was something that everybody accepted and understood that it's for the good of your neighbor. Other communities may not see it that way, and that's unfortunate.
Are you optimistic? I know you're optimistic. Do you see the struggle being short-term, long-term?
Long-term.
Yeah.
And there's one huge point of optimism and one huge point of pessimism. So the huge point of optimism is the vaccine results that came out this morning on the 90% efficacy of a Pfizer vaccine that should be deployable in January if everything goes well. But the huge point of pessimism is that right now we're on this extreme upwards trajectory. So we were at 130,000 cases over the weekend per day. And if all this continues in this direction with no help from the federal government and not enough resources at the state level, we're going to get to 300,000 deaths by the end of the year.
Yeah.
And by the time the vaccine is being rolled out, we're going to be in the worst part of this epidemic.
Now, Pfizer's indicating it's going to file an emergency use application with U.S. regulators, which means what, in layman's terms?
Which means that they get to deploy the vaccine and have it be approved by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, on a much more rapid schedule than a typical drug that the FDA approves. And this is normal for emergencies. When something like this becomes available, you want it to be approved in a week. You don't want to wait through 3 months of backlog at the FDA to get your approval.
You put it at the top of the list of approvals, so at the top of the pile when they're looking at it. That being said, do you feel any corners were cut to get here?
No. I'll say that Pfizer hasn't released all their data yet. Their press release had some details, and it all looks pretty good. The one thing that's missing, this is a medium-term concern, but the one thing that's missing in the press release is how long this efficacy lasts.
Right.
And most people that have read through the design of this trial can kind of see that the vaccine efficacy is going to be 90% for 3, 4, 5, 6 months about. And we're going to need about 6 more months of data to see how long that efficacy lasts.
Can you keep producing everybody keeps getting a little booster every 6 months?
In the worst case scenario, yes.
Yeah.
You would have to keep producing this vaccine and give it to people once a year, and in a really bad scenario, twice a year. I'm not that pessimistic, but we do have to wait for the data.
Storage at minus 80 degrees, too.
This is normal.
Okay.
So lots of genetic material. This is an mRNA-based vaccine.
Yep.
Lots of genetic material that you want preserved has to be stored at minus 80.
Who would you give it to first?
The elderly. So for a 90% effective vaccine, you go from oldest to youngest directly in sequence, and you give it to healthcare workers who are in contact with people that are exposed. 90% is very high, so you don't want to overcomplicate things. You take the people most at risk, and you vaccinate those first.
What age do you define senior at? 65?
Well, you would actually start with over 80s, then you'd go to over 75s,
okay.
Over 70s. Just start from the oldest people in the population.
And work your
way
down.
To do it.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. Boy, you've always come with great information. I appreciate it. Dr. Maciek Boni, Associate Prof, Biology, Penn State. Thank you, sir.
Leslie, thank you so much.
Until next time. 11:18 on the other side, Graham Richardson will join me. News Talk 580, CFRS.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Big story in the COVID front, I think, is probably the Pfizer announcement this morning that came halfway through the morning show on CTV Morning Live. Pfizer says early data suggests their COVID-19 vaccine is effective. They're actually asking for an emergency use application with the U.S. regulator. We heard from Maciek Boni just before the break saying, in other words, they want to be fast-tracked here to get it working. 90% effective. But then we're also cautioned, hey, wait a minute here. We've heard this before. You heard what the president had to say. This is reality. Well, Graham Richardson, senior anchor here, of course, at CTV News Ottawa, joining me in studio and has just heard someone else who's got a lot of credibility in this circle. Graham, and you're feeling a little more optimistic than those who are sort of holding back, saying with cynicism, don't jump the gun here.
Well, I mean, this is very, very significant, Leslie. Sir John Bell is heavily involved with this. He tells BBC Radio, The World at One, like a worldwide broadcaster. The host asks him, first of all, this is not the only one, Pfizer. The others are very, very close. And she asks, is it possible by the end of the year we're going to have multiple vaccines distributed in the UK? And he says yes. And he said that she asked, she quite bluntly asked, is life going to get back to normal by the spring? And he said yes three times.
Huh.
So this is someone, again, like, we had some fairly vigorous discussions about this. Like, if it's just Pfizer and it's just a news release and it's not a peer-reviewed study, fair enough.
Spin.
Right.
Right.
But you got to remember here, remember Tylenol and the poisoned, the tampering?
Mm-hmm.
Like, a company's beyond reputation is on the line here. And I just don't believe that a company like Pfizer is going to cook something like this and put it out knowing the way the world is being ravaged by this virus with nothing behind it.
And if it fails, it kills them, potentially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that there is real science. Obviously, there's real science behind here. What does it mean? Is it going to stay at 90%? If it's at 90%, some scientists were saying they would be happy with 50% plus. 90% is like measles,
yeah,
right? And measles, if you're vaccinated, is essentially eradicated,
mm-hmm,
right? So, no, don't get too far ahead of ourselves. And this will take a long time to distribute. Like, it's not going to be overnight. But you also have to remember all of these, there's 11 or 12 of them, and many of them are coming coming due from the phase three trials all at the same time.
Also something, there's a lot of cooperation between the pharmaceuticals, from what I understand, the researchers in particular, for an obvious reason. This is a global issue.
Yes, and it is. And the other thing to keep in mind as well is that they have been very reserved because they're scientists and they have to do proper clinical trials. And they can't just rush it out there.
Yeah.
So I still go back to Bill Gates talking to The Economist several months ago, and he's put hundreds of millions into this.
Yeah.
And he says the medical piece on this thing will be done in 2021. And if this other guy is right to the BBC, that's about right. If you vaccinate people, if things start rolling again spring, summer normally, that means that a lot of people have been vaccinated.
I think the difference of having somewhat of an end date is a game changer for everybody.
Yes.
Give or take a couple of months, we'll take it. Because at this point, we're desperate. We're hungry for some good news.
Well, and we're heading into a winter. Our cases are going up.
Yeah.
And John Bell also tells BBC, says the only way to get on this thing is with a vaccine. Unless you're an island nation, and we can have debates about whether the governments of Alberta and Ontario are doing the right thing. There's people out there saying they're absolutely not doing the right thing and that the cases are out of control. But we're not a totalitarian state. We share a large border with the United States. We still have goods coming into and out of the United States, which coronavirus is out of control there by any measure.
Yeah.
So they say the only way you can get this under control is through vaccination. So we're a step closer to that today.
Which is great news.
Yeah.
We lost a favorite here. We claim him as our own in Ottawa. Alex Trebek, of course, born further north, but he went to school here. He considered Ottawa key for him when it came to his framing him as a human being and what a human being he was, much more than just the host of a game show, as we know. Lisa LaFlamme, you guys, of course, at CTV Ottawa, had a chance to speak to him in his final months. But
Patricia's a massive fan. Massive.
I saw that on Twitter, and she got to talk to him after the diagnosis. The last interview, at least we know of, has just been released. There's a short excerpt I want you to hear. It's for 2020. It's TJ Holmes as the reporter. And listen how honest and real Alex Trebek is being about his diagnosis.
I've been doing a lot more reading than I have in the past. And that's good because I don't sleep well. I'm usually up 3 or 4 hours during the night, and I go down to my desk and I grab a book and read.
That's every night, 3 or 4 hours you're up every night? That's just uncomfortable or pain.
It is. It weakens me for the daylight hours, unfortunately. The chemotherapy takes something out of me. The immunotherapy program that I've started takes something out of me also. So you combine those two with not sleeping at night, and I'm a basket case in the morning. There was one day a few weeks ago when Jeannie asked me in the morning, how do you feel? And I said, I feel like I want to die. It was that bad.
What does your wife say to you when you say something like that to her?
I apologize to her. and explained that it has nothing to do with my love for her or my feelings for her. It just has to do with the fact that I feel like I'm a terrible burden to her, and that bothers me tremendously.
Do you use that word, burden, with your wife?
Yeah, I've used that.
And she says what to you when you
say
that?
She says, you're not a burden. She's a saint. But she has so much goodness in her that she is always giving out, always putting out to help me get over difficult moments. And there have been some difficult moments. I'm just in awe of the way she handles it.
She knows you.
Yeah. We've been together a long time, 30 years.
You just had that anniversary, right?
Yep.
30-year anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And they said it would never last. Well, wait a minute. That was me.
What a man. Uh-huh. I mean, what hard to hear, right? Mm-hmm. 2 days or a day after we've lost him. But there he is, ending it on the, I guess,
positive.
Typical Alex Trebek. What is it about Ottawa and this love affair with
Alex? I think he's just the quintessential everyman who's smarter than everybody in the room. And you know it. But he doesn't make you feel bad about it. And just that connection he's had for so many years. I personally have not been a massive fan of the show. I just know a lot about him.
Yeah.
And I'm just, as you would know, like a run like that is not just because of Jeopardy, right? Like when they rebranded and restarted in the mid-80s, they were probably hoping for a season or two. And it takes off largely because of him.
Yeah.
Because of his demeanor, his rapport, his everymanness, even though he is clearly highly, highly intelligent and very quick on television.
Quick story. I actually auditioned for a game show that was news-based and died poorly in the audition, and that's when I knew how good he was.
Different game, huh?
Well, you know, because yeah, you think sure. You know it, because we follow the news every day right. For decades, right? It's what we do. But then to get up there and to be able to do it in such a format like that, it takes a gift. And that's why there was only one Jeopardy host that really lasted the test of time.
Yeah, it's very sad. And the other thing, such self-awareness. He reminds me of Peter Jennings, the way he faced cancer. Talking about millions of other people who have cancer and being so self-aware of his position and the messages he was sending and the fact that he talked about death and he's not afraid of death. And apparently he was in the studio 12 days ago.
Yeah, it got more episodes. The last one's going to air on Christmas Day. Interesting you say Jennings. You know, there's an Ottawa boy.
Yeah.
And there's Alex Trebek. We claim him as because he spent so many years here. Mm. Maybe it is something about,
I don't know,
about this city.
It's the winter.
Yeah.
It's very
keeps
sad,
you real.
Very sad to see him go, but what a life. What a life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Graham. Always
thanks,
good to
Leslie.
Talk to you. Graham Richardson from CTV News. 11:31, we'll break for news. News Talk 580, CFRA.